Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 9, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome John C. Richter, who's a partner at the law firm of King & Spalding. He's also a former U.S. attorney. A more complete bio of Mr. Richter and his career in criminal law were provided to you in notice of the call. So stop there and preserve more time for his presentation and followed by your questions. So without any further ado, Mr. Richter, the floor is yours.
Great, and good morning, everyone. I appreciate your patience in holding on. So today I'll be speaking about Ohio versus Clark and look forward to your questions about it. Ohio versus Clark is an interesting case, mainly because it comes in a long line of cases stemming from the Supreme Court's decision in Crawford versus Washington in 2004, which overturned a case called Ohio versus Roberts from 1982. What's interesting about this case law since the decision in Crawford in 2004 is that the Supreme Court's subsequent decisions following Crawford have called into question the stability of the Confrontation Clause doctrine that was stated in that Crawford decision. There's been great division in the subsequent decisions amongst the justices. And this case of Ohio versus Clark, which involved a child abuse case, is an opportunity for the court to determine whether it is going to continue its internal divisions and both about the factors to be considered when considering Confrontation Clause issues in the context of out-of-court statements that are offered for the truth of the matter asserted against a witness, against a defendant in a criminal case, and the chaos that seemingly exists in that area of the law currently, or to come together into some degree of unification, at least as it regards the treatment of statements by children in child abuse or sex abuse cases, which, of course, are bread-and-butter cases nationwide, particularly, of course, in the state criminal justice systems and, to a lesser degree, in federal cases involving federal lands or Indian country or territorial jurisdiction. What I'll do in this quick presentation is to briefly summarize to the degree I can and do it justice the line of cases stemming from Crawford up until this case, give you a bit of background on the case, and then cover the summary of the argument, the case, the perspective of the arguing parties, highlights about the justices' comments during the oral argument, and then my predictions. And then we'll turn it over to you for questions and further discussion. So turning first then to the line of cases and the background here, Ohio versus Roberts had been a decision that essentially came up with a nine-factor test for dealing with confrontational clause issues and the question of the admissibility of out-of-court statements by a witness that were offered against a defendant in a criminal trial. Essentially, that nine-factor test was a multi-factor test designed to gauge reliability, the so-called, quote, guarantees of trustworthiness, unquote. In Crawford versus Washington, Justice Scalia, writing for the court, turned everything upside down and basically held that the Confrontation Clause was a more absolute provision of the Constitution Then the multi-factor test of Ohio versus Roberts. He looked predictably to the history of confrontation rights and abuses in England and early American case law, and concluded that the Confrontation Clause was neither aimed exclusively at in-court testimony nor applicable to all of out-of-court statements, but reflected really an acute concern with the specific types of out-of-court statements, those essentially that referred to witnesses against the accused, and really therefore turned and defined that as witness, as someone who bears testimony against the defendant. For purposes of today's discussion, the seminal part of that decision that it made its way forward was that it in Crawford, the court took a very declarant-oriented focus on the potential admissibility of the out-of-court statement, really, and the question was whether those statements were made under circumstances that would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. It was a declarant-focused objective test. Was this declarant really contemplating at the time that he made the out-of-court statement that this was he was going to be bearing testimony against a defendant in a court of law? The next case that moved this line of cases forward, this confrontation clause area forward, was Davis versus Washington. 2 years later, in which the court was trying to further clarify the definition of testimonial statements. Davis and a companion case called Hammond versus Indiana both involved domestic violence prosecutions. Davis involved the recording of a 911 call. Hammond involved some statements that were made to police as they were responding to the domestic disturbance call and found a frightened wife of the accused. In both cases, the Supreme Court held that the testimony had been properly admitted and that therefore it did not violate the Confrontation Clause. And the court there held that statements were non-testimonial when made in the course of police interrogation where the circumstances objectively indicate that the primary purpose of the interrogation was to meet an ongoing emergency as opposed to generate testimony. But this the decisions in these cases did give rise to a great deal of debate in the academic world about the potential inconsistencies between this objective declarant rule stemming from Crawford and then the Davis's primary purpose definition. Following those two cases, there were three different cases, Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts, Michigan versus Bryant, and Williams versus Illinois, that put further confusion into the mix with regard to how the Confrontation Clause jurisprudence governs the analysis of out-of-court statements that are offered against an accused. Melendez-Diaz essentially basically demonstrated that this primary purpose test did not displace the three Crawford tests, except possibly in the context of police interrogations. Michigan versus Bryant was a particularly particularly important in terms of changing and further throwing into question this and rendering unstable this area of the law, in that in Michigan versus Bryant, the court considered the Davis primary purpose test and the ongoing emergency test for applying the Confrontation Clause to police interrogations. The court in the majority also then held that in Confrontation Clause cases, it was important to take into account not only the declarant's objective view of the declarant's purpose for his statements, but also the listener's view and the circumstances surrounding it. Justice Scalia, the father of Crawford versus Washington, the author of basically the decisions of Davis and Crawford, and of course who had had really made, was the drive for this change in the confrontation clause analysis, for the first time in this line of cases, dissented. And it's a pretty scathing dissent. He found the court's turn in Michigan versus Bryant particularly troubling because of the importance placed on the perspective of the interrogator, the questioner, as it seemed to essentially reintroduce the reliability test that had been struck down in the Crawford case. The court then finally decided in June of 2012, Williams versus Illinois. Williams, and as indicative of the instability of this area and the division within the court, did not even produce a majority holding. Four justices, in an opinion written by Justice Alito, stated in this case, dealing with an expert report, that the expert's testimony, even though he was relying on report based on a laboratory report based on a witness who was not presented at trial, did not violate the confrontation clause because the expert who did testify, the court said that his statements were not offered to prove the truth of the laboratory report's contents, notwithstanding that they really were, and secondly, that the confrontation clause was not implicated because the testimony itself did, and the underlying lab reports did not have the primary purpose of accusing a targeted individual. In that case, it was a DNA test that just simply said, this is the DNA that was found on at the scene of the crime. It did not identify a particular individual. There was not a majority decision. There were a lot of differing opinions as to how this was supposed to be decided. And the long and the short of it is that it further rendered this whole area of the law is pretty confused. In terms of then turning to Ohio versus Clark, this case involved again a situation in which you were having out-of-court statements. In this case, it was the first time that it was dealing with out-of-court statements by a child. Always an area that has the opportunity to make decisions difficult. And in the case, there's a pretty good summary on the website of what happened in it factually. But put in short form, essentially you had a situation in which a child identified by the initials LP was in the custody of his mother's boyfriend. He went to school. A teacher noticed that he had some bruises and red marks on his face. The teacher talked to the boy, asking him who had hurt him. He replied, D, and it turned out that that was the name by which his mother's boyfriend was called. A supervisor to the teacher then found bruises and other injuries on the boy's body. They called an emergency telephone line for reporting child abuse. He was then further interviewed by social workers. And ultimately, of course, an investigation led to Darius Clark, the defendant in this case, being charged with an assault on the boy, assault on his little sister, and endangering children, engaging in domestic violence. Clark was tried with the judge allowing over the defense lawyer's objections the use of testimony from seven people who had talked with the boy and heard his alleged abuse. He was convicted and sentenced to 28 years in prison. The Ohio Supreme Court ultimately reversed the decision in a split decision 4-3 and ruled that the two daycare teachers should be treated as law enforcement agents because of a duty imposed by state law to report information about child abuse and neglect. and that the boys' statements to them therefore qualified as testimonial within the meaning of Crawford versus Washington, and therefore should not have been admitted at trial, and it therefore ordered a new trial. Obviously, the case was then cert was ultimately granted in this case, and the briefs of the respective parties argued first from the state side. The state of Ohio urged the court to adopt a flat rule that the Confrontation Clause simply does not apply to statements meant for private parties without further police direction, and then said as a fallback position that even if the court was unwilling to establish a bright line rule, non-law enforcement rule, that at least statements originating from a child found too young to testify should be seen as non-testimonial, since the child presumably could not form the objective his testimony, that he would be bearing testimony in a future court proceeding. The defense, in contrast, countered that the Confrontation Clause should apply to these statements were made by the teachers, because the teachers in the first were essentially served as the perfect substitute for trial testimony. In fact, teachers had a duty to report under Ohio law, and that therefore they were effectively acting as listeners in interrogating the child, and therefore obtaining these out-of-court statements. The defense further argued that, as I'll get into in a moment, that Ohio law and the construction of Ohio's hearsay rules also sort of made these teachers effectively always in a position of being the agent for the state for purposes of the admissibility of a child's statements in the context of child abuse of any sort. In terms of the background on the case, of course, there were numerous amicus briefs filed on behalf of 42 states in Washington, D.C., and there was also then obviously amicus filed on behalf of the defendant from a number of criminal defense lawyers, legal academics, the Innocence Network, and various other advocacy groups. Additionally, it's important that the Ohio Supreme Court case did conflict with a number of other state and federal court decisions at the lower level, and so the case was presented in that posture. In terms of the summary of the argument last week, the prosecutor on behalf of the state of Ohio and the Department of Justice's Solicitor General's office both argued, of course, as one might expect, about the lack of the fact that these statements by a three-year-old, LP, a three-year-old, lacked any type of indicia that would suggest that he had an objective intent that they to be bearing testimony in a future court proceeding. And from a declarant's perspective, therefore, consistent with Justice Scalia's original formulation in Crawford, that in and of itself could end the inquiry. They further argued, of course, on the other factors that had been developed in the Bryant case, that likewise the teachers in this case their primary purpose was simply to concern about the well-being of the child. The argument was also made, of course, that they were trying to make sure that the child would not be released back to the custody of someone who might do him further harm, and that therefore their primary purpose was not for purposes of obtaining testimony and investigating the case with the idea of a court proceeding, but rather much more along the lines of the near-term emergency and safety of the child aspects. Defense counsel Jeff Fisher out of Stanford was arguing on behalf of the defendant. He argued that the teacher was effectively acting as an agent of the state, that the purpose of Ohio law put teachers in a position to effectively be investigating cases of child and sexual abuse for future prosecution, that the state of Ohio, he made the points, had created a hearsay exception that it would allow statements of children, of child witnesses under the age of 12 to out-of-court statements to be admitted, and then it also made children under the age of 10 incompetent per se to testify at trial, and that the combination of these rules essentially demonstrated that the teachers, therefore, were always a substitute under Ohio law for live testimony, and that, therefore, their role was effectively as an agent for the state and thereby rendering this testimonial for purposes of the Confrontation Clause. The justices' reactions during the argument, number one, evinced really no appetite ultimately for a law enforcement only bright line rule that would make this area of the law clearer in the context at least of child abuse or sexual abuse cases. Even Justice Scalia posed a question that suggested that some non-law enforcement statements could be testimonial, and so it seems pretty self-evident to the degree you can ever read the tea leaves of the United States Supreme Court from argument that there's not a lot of appetite for a bright line rule as the state had asked in the case. Secondly, Justice Kagan posed a hypothetical in which she posed the question of what would happen if you had a 13-year-old who was speaking to a teacher, and the teacher actually walked through and was clear about the fact of the role she was playing, that the information she was gathering would be passed on potentially to police, and would that therefore, at what point in time would that trigger the fact that these statements might be deemed testimonial, given the potential notice that the 13-year-old would be on, as well as the view of the listener in that case and the circumstances. Effectively, that hypothetical posed by Justice Kagan, I think, killed any chance of a law enforcement bright line rule being handed down by the court in this decision. At least, that's my best prediction. Thirdly, I think in listening to the justices, I think the majority of the justices, Ginsburg, Alito, Sotomayor, Kennedy, Roberts, certainly seemed open to the Bryant analysis, the three-part analysis of looking at the declarant's objective view, the listener's objective view, and the circumstances surrounding it, very much focused, therefore, on a case-by-case analysis and whether or not the statement was really being made to help a police investigation or for other purposes. I think that Justice Kagan was the most negative in terms of the prosecution's view in this case. She raised some questions. She was the one that tried to articulate the best argument that the defendant had in this case. She made the point that she believed the strongest part of the case went something like this, that this is a statement that was going to come in and have great consequence at a trial. It's essentially going to be the most relevant kind of testimony imaginative that you can imagine. It's an accusation. It's essentially an accusation of a 3-year-old as to who did it, that the fact that the defense would not be able to cross-examine anyone about it or raise questions about the accuracy or why this 3-year-old might have motive to focus on focus on him versus someone else would, you know, obviously made it very difficult and therefore potentially scary in terms of use of state power and obtaining a conviction. I think Justice Kagan was also particularly concerned in her questioning as to the difficulty of fitting a diminished capacity declarant. So in this case, a 3-year-old, but for potentially in other cases in the future, essentially the diminished capacity would seemingly, and therefore a less reliable statement, would seemingly be more admissible under this line of jurisprudence than not. So it would be more admissible the less the declarant could objectively have known that the statement could bear testimony in a future proceeding. Turning finally now to sort of predicting where things may go, I think my best guess would be that the court will not issue an opinion that gives a bright line rule that statements that are not made to non-law enforcement actors by children are admissible. I think my best guess would be that there will be some majority that will reverse the conviction that will coalesce around looking at the three factors articulated in the Bryant decision, that you have a 3-year-old who can therefore not form the objective testimonial intent, that you had teachers whose primary purpose really was not to gather evidence but rather to look out for the safety of the child. It's hard to say how Justice Scalia will react, but if he follows the Crawford analysis and the declarant view, which we would expect him to do, that he's likely to at least concur that this case should be reversed under these particular facts. Justice Ginsburg, who has been generally pro-defendant in this line of cases and therefore in the dissent in most of these cases, seems very concerned about the safety and well-being of the child and the focus of the teacher on that. So we may see Justice Ginsburg also join the majority in this particular case. If there's any chance of someone truly dissenting in the case and therefore voting to affirm the Ohio Supreme Court case and therefore reverse the conviction, I think it's going to be Justice Kagan. So that's a quick summary, getting through the case and the background here as quickly as possible. I think in sum total, I would expect that the petitioner, in this case the state of Ohio, will win this case. The question will really come down to whether they will win based on a majority holding that attempts to put some greater unity and reduce the division in the court about the perspective of how the Confrontation Clause should work, or whether you get a decision that is still split on maybe unified in outcome, but split on methodology as to how one should analyze these kinds of cases. I'll stop there and look forward to questions and comments that the audience may have.
All right. Now we'll open up the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. So again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we had our first question jump on the line.
Yes, sir. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm a Federalist Society member. I'm also a teacher, and so this case has a lot of interest for me personally and professionally. When I listened through the oral arguments, listened to the recordings of that, I don't know. I came away with the impression that the court would go against the state of Ohio, and you seem to think that it's not going to happen that way. If in fact they do rule for the state, my question has to do with, you know, with teachers. Do you think that the Supreme Court will uphold Ohio's view that teachers are agents of law enforcement when they gather this information? And I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Well, Mark, obviously, it goes without saying that predicting the Supreme Court is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And that the only way you know what the Supreme Court meant in any decision is in the cases that actually follow the one that they decide, when they tell you what they actually meant in the prior decision, notwithstanding what you thought they said.
Right.
But with all those caveats, I'll certainly, and at the risk of being proven wrong and stupid, I will nonetheless give my best shot here.
The Supreme Court makes a lot of people look stupid sometimes.
I think in terms of the perspective of teachers, I think for purposes of the Confrontation Clause, it's while the court a few of the justices expressed particularly a little bit of mild concern about the rules of evidence that Ohio has, the hearsay rules, and the rule that obviously makes children sort of per se incompetent to testify. I suspect that is not ultimately going to be the seminal thing that decides this case.
I didn't think it would either. I didn't think so either.
There was some discussion about the question as to whether a due process challenge to those particular rules might have any currency. But the due process question was not before the court in this case, so I think they will stay away from that. I think the court. I think very few members of the court are going to be of the view that teachers, when they are that teachers per se are actors or state actors or police essentially for purposes.
Right.
Of this analysis, simply because there is a reporting requirement under
right.
Ohio law. There are plenty of other states that have similar reporting
rules. I think actually all the states do.
Yeah. But I think so the mere fact that a person may have a reporting requirement is a fact, but not likely to be automatically outcome determinative. Instead, where I think the court, the majority of justices at least, are likely to see that is that may be relevant to the circumstances analysis. It may be relevant to the question of looking at the listener's primary purpose.
Right.
But assuming the teacher is not engaged in, assuming that the record in hindsight in any particular case shows the teacher really focused on the safety of the child at the time,
right.
acting really for purposes of simply gathering a case after the fact and investigating the case after the fact, I think there is at least a narrow majority on the court that are going to be comfortable that fact pattern alone, at least for purposes of that element, does not trigger a confrontation clause.
I wonder too that considering that I agree with you. I think that the several of the justices expressed that the teacher's primary purpose was protection and safety, and I was wondering if that might lead this to be to fall under a exclusion rule, a hearsay exclusion exception.
Well, again. For purposes of the Confrontation Clause, the court, this whole line of cases makes it clear that, you know, that the hearsay rules aren't the driver, right? That they're irrelevant. The only question is whether the statement itself is testimonial such that it would be barred as a matter of constitutional right. Whether if it's not barred by the Confrontation Clause, then the next question would be whether it would be under state hearsay rules, which have no constitutional import, that only extreme theoretically could have due process in court, but we've never seen a case, obviously, in which a traditional hearsay rule has ever been successfully challenged for a due process violation.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, sir. I appreciate your answer very much.
Well, thanks for your question.
All right. Well, we have about 5 minutes left, so if you would like to jump on and ask a question, press star and then the pound key. And just a reminder for any of you that tuned in earlier and then may have dropped off while we were having technical difficulties and came on later, this podcast or this telephone call will be available on our website as a podcast, along with all of our other telephone conference calls. So if you missed any part of the call or want to listen again to any of the call, you can always find it on our website at fedsoc.org. I do want to make one quick programming announcement. Our next scheduled teleforum conference call will be tomorrow, March 10th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time sponsored by the Religious Liberties Practice Group on a new book called The Rise and Decline of American Religious Freedom. So again, and you can find our schedule for the rest of our teleforum conference calls for the week on our website as well or in our weekly email. So let's go ahead and do one last call for questions while we have a few minutes left. So star and then the pound key. Well, it looks like we've exhausted the questions and come in just under time. So I want to apologize for our technical difficulties earlier, let everyone know that if you have colleagues or contacts who called in but were scared away by our technical difficulties, let them know that the call did happen and we'll be posting the podcast of this call on our website. I want to thank our expert, John Richter, for being with us today, for giving a great presentation, and we'd love to have you back again sometime. So thank you very much. And until next time, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.